I endeavoured to prolong it. I allowed each of my inflections to hang lazily upon its word. I felt each glance from my eyes arrive just at the spot to which it was directed, and stay there beyond the normal period. Now, sit still and rest, said my grandmother. If you can't manage to sleep, read something. And she handed me a volume of Madame de Sévigné, which I opened, while she buried herself in the Mémoire de Madame de Beausergent. She never travelled anywhere without a volume of each. They were her two favourite authors. With no conscious movement of my head, feeling a keen pleasure in maintaining a posture after I had adopted it, I lay back holding in my hands the volume of Madame de Sévigné, which I had allowed to close without lowering my eyes to it, or indeed letting them see anything but the blue window blind. But the contemplation of this blind appeared to me an admirable thing, and I should not have troubled to answer anyone who might have sought to distract me from contemplating it. The blue colour of this blind seemed to me, not perhaps by its beauty, but by its intense vivacity, to efface so completely all the colours that had passed before my eyes from the day of my birth up to the moment in which I had gulped down the last of my drink and it had begun to take effect, that when compared with this blue, they were as drab, as void as must be retrospectively the darkness in which he has lived to a man born blind, whom a subsequent operation has at length enabled to see and to distinguish colours. An old ticket collector came to ask for our tickets. The silvery gleam that shone from the metal buttons of his jacket charmed me in spite of my absorption. I wanted to ask him to sit down beside us, but he passed on to the next carriage, and I thought with longing of the life led by railwaymen, for whom, since they spent all their time on the line, hardly a day could pass without their seeing this old collector. The pleasure that I found in staring at the blind, and in feeling that my mouth was half open, began at length to diminish. I became more mobile. I even moved in my seat. I opened the book that my grandmother had given me and turned its pages casually, reading whatever caught my eye. And as I read, I felt my admiration for Madame de Sévigné grow. It is a mistake to let oneself be taken in by the purely formal details, idioms of the period or social conventions, the effect of which is that certain people believe that they have caught the Sévigné manner when they have said, "Tell me, my dear," or, "That count struck me as being a man of parts," or, "Haymaking is the sweetest thing in the world." Madame de Simian imagines already that she is being like her grandmother because she can write, "Monsieur de la Boulie is bearing wonderfully, sir, and is in excellent condition to hear the news of his death." Or, "Oh, my dear Marquis, how your letter enchanted me. What can I do but answer it?" Or, "Meseems, sir, that you owe me a letter, and I owe you some boxes of bergamot. I discharge my debt to the number of 8. Others shall follow. Never has the soil borne so many. Apparently for your gratification." And she writes in this style also her letter on bleeding, on lemons, and so forth, supposing it to be typical of the letters of Madame de Sévigné. But my grandmother, who had approached that lady from within, attracted to her by her own love of kinsfolk and of nature, had taught me to enjoy the real beauties of her correspondence, which are altogether different. They were presently to strike me all the more forcibly, inasmuch as Madame de Sévigné is a great artist of the same school as a painter whom I was to meet at Balbec, where his influence on my way of seeing things was immense. I realized at Balbec that it was in the same way as he that she presented things to her readers, in the order of our perception of them, instead of first having to explain them in relation to their several causes. But already that afternoon in the railway carriage, as I read over again that letter in which the moonlight comes, I cannot resist the temptation. I put on all my bonnets and veils, though there is no need of them. I walk along this mall, where the air is as sweet as in my chamber. I find a thousand phantasms, monks white and black, sisters grey and white, linen cast here and there on the ground, men enshrouded upright against the tree trunks. I was enraptured by what, a little later, I should have described, for does not she draw landscapes in the same way as he draws characters, as the Dostoyevsky side of Madame de Sévigné's letters. When that evening, after having accompanied my grandmother to her destination and spent some hours in her friend's house, I had returned by myself to the train, at any rate I found nothing to distress me in the night which followed. This was because I had not to spend it in a room, the somnolence of which would have kept me awake. I was surrounded by the soothing activity of all those movements of the train which kept me company, offered to stay and converse with me if I could not sleep, lulled me with their sounds which I wedded, as I had often wedded the chime of the Cambrai bells, now to one rhythm, now to another, hearing as the whim took me, first four level and equivalent semiquavers, then one semiquaver furiously dashing against a crotchet. They neutralized the centrifugal force of my insomnia by exercising upon it a contrary pressure, which kept me in equilibrium, and on which my immobility and presently my drowsiness felt themselves to be borne with the same sense of refreshment that I should have had I been resting under the protecting vigilance of powerful forces on the breast of nature and of life, had I been able for a moment to incarnate myself in a fish that sleeps in the sea, driven unheeding by the currents and the tides, or in an eagle outstretched upon the air with no support but the storm. Sunrise is a necessary concomitant of long railway journeys, just as are hard-boiled eggs, illustrated papers, packs of cards, rivers upon which boats strain but make no progress. At a certain moment, when I was counting over the thoughts that had filled my mind in the preceding minutes so as to discover whether I had just been asleep or not, and when the very uncertainty which made me ask myself the question was to furnish me with an affirmative answer, in the pale square of the window, over a small black wood, I saw some ragged clouds whose fleecy edges were of a fixed, dead pink, not liable to change, like the colour that dyes the wing which has grown to wear it, or the sketch upon which the artist's fancy has washed it. But I felt that, unlike them, this colour was due neither to inertia nor to caprice, but to necessity and life. Presently, there gathered behind it reserves of light. It brightened. The sky turned to a crimson, which I strove, gluing my eyes to the window, to see more clearly, for I felt that it was related somehow to the most intimate life of nature. But, the course of the line altering, the train turned, the morning scene gave place in the frame of the window to a nocturnal village, its roofs still blue with moonlight, its pond encrusted with the opalescent nacre of night, beneath the firmament still powdered with all its stars. And I was lamenting the loss of my strip of pink sky when I caught sight of it afresh, but red this time, in the opposite window, which it left at a second bend in the line, so that I spent my time running from one window to the other to reassemble, to collect on a single canvas the intermittent antipodean fragments of my fine, scarlet, ever-changing morning, and to obtain a comprehensive view of it and a continuous picture. The scenery became broken, abrupt. The train stopped at a little station between two mountains. Far down the gorge, on the edge of a hurrying stream, one could see only a solitary watch-house, deep planted in the water, which ran past on a level with its windows. If a person can be the product of a soil, the peculiar charm of which one distinguishes in that person, more even than the peasant girl whom I had so desperately longed to see appear when I wandered by myself along the Méséglise way, in the woods of Roussainville, such a person must be the big girl whom I now saw emerge from the house, and climbing a path lighted by the first slanting rays of the sun, come towards the station carrying a jar of milk. In her valley, from which its congregated summits hid the rest of the world, she could never see anyone save in these trains which stopped for a moment only. She passed down the line of windows, offering coffee and milk to a few awakened passengers. Purpled with the glow of morning, her face was rosier than the sky. I felt in her presence that desire to live which is reborn in us whenever we become conscious anew of beauty and happiness. We invariably forget that these are individual qualities, and substituting for them in our mind a conventional type at which we arrive by striking a sort of mean amongst the different faces that have taken our fancy, the pleasures we have known, we are left with mere abstract images which are lifeless and dull because they are lacking in precisely that element of novelty, different from anything we have known, that element which is proper to beauty and to happiness. And we deliver on life a pessimistic judgment which we suppose to be fair, for we believed that we were taking into account when we formed it happiness and beauty, whereas in fact we left them out and replaced them by syntheses in which there is not a single atom of either. So it is that a well-read man will at once begin to yawn with boredom when anyone speaks to him of a new good book, because he imagines a sort of composite of all the good books that he has read and knows already, whereas a good book is something special, something incalculable, and is made up not of the sum of all previous masterpieces, but of something which the most thorough assimilation of every one of them would not enable him to discover, since it exists not in their sum, but beyond it. Once he has become acquainted with this new work, the well-read man, till then apathetic, feels his interest awaken in the reality which it depicts. So, alien to the models of beauty which my fancy was wont to sketch when I was by myself, this strapping girl gave me at once the sensation of a certain happiness, the sole form always different in which we may learn the sensation of happiness, of a happiness that would be realized by my staying and living there by her side. But in this again, the temporary cessation of habit played a great part. I was giving the milk girl the benefit of what was really my own entire being, ready to taste the keenest joys which now confronted her. As a rule, it is with our being reduced to a minimum that we live. Most of our faculties lie dormant because they can rely upon habit, which knows what there is to be done and has no need of their services. But on this morning of travel, the interruption of the routine of my existence, the change of place and time, had made their presence indispensable. My habits, which were sedentary and not matutinal, played me false, and all my faculties came hurrying to take their place, vying with one another in their zeal, rising each of them like waves in a storm to the same unaccustomed level, from the basest to the most exalted, from breath, appetite, the circulation of my blood, to receptivity and imagination. I cannot say whether, so as to make me believe that this girl was unlike the rest of women, the rugged charm of these barren tracts had been added to her own, but if so, she gave it back to them. Life would have seemed an exquisite thing to me if only I had been free to spend it hour after hour with her, to go with her to the stream, to the cow, to the train, to be always at her side, to feel that I was known to her, had my place in her thoughts. She would have initiated me into the delights of country life and of the first hours of the day. I signalled to her to give me some of her coffee. I felt that I must be noticed by her. She did not see me. I called to her. Above her body, which was of massive build, the complexion of her face was so burnished and so ruddy that she appeared almost as though I were looking at her through a lighted window. She had turned and was coming towards me. I could not take my eyes from her face, which grew larger as she approached, like a sun which it was somehow possible to arrest in its course and draw towards one, letting itself be seen at close quarters, blinding the eyes with its blaze of red and gold. She fastened on me her penetrating stare, but while the porters ran along the platform shutting doors, the train had begun to move. I saw her leave the station and go down the hill to her home. It was broad daylight now. I was speeding away from the dawn. Whether my exaltation had been produced by this girl, or had on the other hand been responsible for most of the pleasure that I had found in the sight of her, in the sense of her presence, in either event she was so closely associated with it that my desire to see her again was really not so much a physical as a mental desire, not to allow this state of enthusiasm to perish utterly, not to be separated forever from the person who, although quite unconsciously, had participated in it. It was not only because this state was a pleasant one, it was principally because, just as increased tension upon a cord or accelerated vibration of a nerve produces a different sound or colour, it gave another tonality to all that I saw, introduced me as an actor upon the stage of an unknown and infinitely more interesting universe. That handsome girl whom I still could see while the train gathered speed was like part of a life other than the life that I knew, separated from it by a clear boundary, in which the sensations that things produced in me were no longer the same. From which to return now to my old life would be almost suicide. To procure myself the pleasure of feeling that I had at least an attachment to this new life, it would suffice that I should live near enough to the little station to be able to come to it every morning for a cup of coffee from the girl. But, alas, she must be forever absent from the other life, towards which I was being borne with ever-increasing swiftness, a life to the prospect of which I resigned myself only by weaving plans that would enable me to take the same train again some day and to stop at the same station, a project which would have the further advantage of providing with subject matter the selfish, active, practical, mechanical, indolent, centrifugal tendency which is that of the human mind. For our mind turns readily aside from the effort which is required if it is to analyze in itself, in a general and disinterested manner, a pleasant impression which we have received. And as, on the other hand, we wish to continue to think of that impression, the mind prefers to imagine it in the future tense, which, while it gives us no clue as to the real nature of the thing, saves us the trouble of recreating it in our own consciousness, and allows us to hope that we may receive it afresh from without. Certain names of towns, Vézelay or Chartres, Bourse or Beauvais, serve to indicate by abbreviation the principal church in those towns. This partial acceptation in which we are so accustomed to take the word comes at length, if the names in question are those of places that we do not yet know, to fashion for us a mould of the name as a solid whole, which from that time onwards, whenever we wish it to convey the idea of the town, of that town which we have never seen, will impose on it, as on a cast, the same carved outlines, in the same style of art, will make of the town a sort of vast cathedral. It was, nevertheless, in a railway station, above the door of a refreshment room, that I read the name, almost Persian in style, of Balbec. I strode buoyantly through the station and across the avenue that led past it. I asked my way to the beach, so as to see nothing in the place but its church and the sea. People seemed not to understand what I meant. Old Balbec, Balbec en terre, at which I had arrived, had neither beach nor harbour. It was most certainly in the sea that the fishermen had found, according to the legend, the miraculous Christ, of which a window in the church that stood a few yards from where I now was recorded the discovery. It was indeed from cliffs battered by the waves that had been quarried the stone of its nave and towers. But this sea, which for those reasons I had imagined as flowing up to die at the foot of the window, was 12 miles away and more, at Balbec Plage, and rising beside its cupola, that steeple which, because I had read that it was itself a rugged Norman cliff on which seeds were blown and sprouted, round which the sea-birds wheeled, I had always pictured to myself as receiving at its base the last drying foam of the uplifted waves, stood on a square, from which 2 lines of tramway diverged, opposite a café which bore, written in letters of gold, the word Billiards. It stood out against a background of houses, with the roofs of which no upstanding mast was blended. And the church, entering my mind with the café, with the passing stranger of whom I had had to ask my way, with the station to which presently I should have to return, made part of the general whole, seemed an accident, a by-product of this summer afternoon, in which its mellow and distended dome against the sky was like a fruit of which the same light that bathed the chimneys of the houses was ripening the skin, pink, glowing, melting soft. But I wished only to consider the eternal significance of the carvings when I recognized the apostles which I had seen in casts in the Trocadero Museum, and which on either side of the Virgin before the deep bay of the porch were awaiting me as though to do me reverence, with their benign, blunt, mild faces and bowed shoulders. They seemed to be advancing upon me with an air of welcome, singing the Alleluia of a fine day. But it was evident that their expression was unchanging as that on a dead man's face, and could be modified only by my turning about to look at them in different aspects. I said to myself, "Here I am. This is the church of Balbec. This square, which looks as though it were conscious of its glory, is the only place in the world that possesses Balbec Church. All that I have seen so far have been photographs of this church, and of these famous apostles, this Virgin of the Porch, mere casts only. Now it is the church itself, the statue itself. These are they, the unique things. This is something far greater." It was something less, perhaps, also. As a young man on the day of an examination or of a duel feels the question that has been asked, the shot that he has fired, to be a very little thing when he thinks of the reserves of knowledge and of valour that he possesses and would like to have displayed, so my mind, which had exalted the Virgin of the Porch far above the reproductions that I had had before my eyes, inaccessible by the vicissitudes which had power to threaten them, intact though they were destroyed, ideal, endowed with universal value, was astonished to see the statue which it had carved 1,000 times, reduced now to its own apparent form in stone, occupying on the radius of my outstretched arm a place in which it had for rivals an election placard, and the point of my stick fettered to the square, inseparable from the head of the main street, powerless to hide from the gaze of the cafe and of the omnibus office, receiving on its face half of that ray of the setting sun, half presently in a few hours' time of the light of the street lamp, of which the bank building received the other half. Tainted simultaneously with that branch office of a money-lending establishment by the smells from the pastry cook's oven, subjected to the tyranny of the individual to such a point that if I had chosen to scribble my name upon that stone, it was she, the illustrious virgin, whom until then I had endowed with a general existence and an intangible beauty. The Virgin of Baalbek, the unique, which meant, alas, the only one, who, on her body coated with the same soot as defiled the neighbouring houses, would have displayed, powerless to rid herself of them, to all the admiring strangers come there to gaze upon her, the marks of my piece of chalk and the letters of my name. It was she, indeed, the immortal work of art so long desired, whom I found transformed, as was the church itself, into a little old woman in stone, whose height I could measure and count her wrinkles. But time was passing. I must return to the station, where I was to wait for my grandmother and Françoise, so that we should all arrive at Baalbek Plage together. I reminded myself of what I had read about Baalbek, of Swan saying, "It is exquisite, as fine as Siena," and casting the blame for my disappointment upon various accidental causes, such as the state of my health, my exhaustion after the journey, my incapacity for looking at things properly, I endeavoured to console myself with the thought that other towns remained still intact for me, that I might soon, perhaps, be making my way, as into a shower of pearls, into the cool, pattering sound that dripped from Quimperlé, cross that green water lit by a rosy glow in which Pont-Aven was bathed. But as for Baalbek, no sooner had I set foot in it than it was as though I had broken open a name which ought to have been kept hermetically closed, and into which, seizing at once the opportunity that I had imprudently given them when I expelled all the images that had been living in it until then, a tramway, a cafe, people crossing the square, the local branch of a bank, irresistibly propelled by some external pressure, by a pneumatic force, had come crowding into the interior of those two syllables, which, closing over them, let them now serve as a border to the porch of the Persian church, and would never henceforward cease to contain them. In the little train of the local railway company, which was to take us to Baalbek Plage, I found my grandmother, but found her alone, for imagining that she was sending Françoise on ahead of her, so as to have everything ready before we arrived, but having mixed up her instructions, she had succeeded only in packing off Françoise in the wrong direction, who at that moment was being carried down all unsuspectingly at full speed to Nantes, and would probably wake up next morning at Bordeaux. No sooner had I taken my seat in the carriage, filled with the fleeting light of sunset and with the lingering heat of the afternoon, the former enabling me, alas, to see written clearly upon my grandmother's face how much the latter had tired her, then she began, "Well, and Baalbek?" with a smile so brightly illuminated by her expectation of the great pleasure which she supposed me to have been enjoying, that I dared not at once confess to her my disappointment. Besides, the impression which my mind had been seeking occupied it steadily less as the place drew nearer to which my body would have to become accustomed. At the end, still more than an hour away, of this journey, I was trying to form a picture of the manager of the hotel at Baalbek, to whom I at that moment did not exist, and I should have liked to be going to present myself to him in more impressive company than that of my grandmother, who would be certain to ask for a reduction of his terms. The only thing positive about him was his haughty condescension. His lineaments were still vague. Every few minutes the little station brought us to a standstill in one of the stations which came before Balbec Plage, stations the mere names of which, Incarville, Marcouville, Deauville, Pont-à-Couleuvre, Arambouville, Saint-Mars-le-Vieux, Ermenonville, Manville, seemed to me outlandish, whereas if I had come upon them in a book, I should at once have been struck by their affinity to the names of certain places in the neighbourhood of Cambrai. But to the trained ear, two musical airs, consisting each of so many notes, several of which are common to them both, will present no similarity whatever if they differ in the colour of their harmony and orchestration. So it was that nothing could have reminded me less than these dreary names, made up of sand, of space too airy and empty, and of salt, out of which the termination ville always escaped, as the fly seems to spring out from the end of the word butterfly. Nothing could have reminded me less of those other names, Roussainville or Martinville, which, because I had heard them pronounced so often by my great-aunt at table in the dining-room, had acquired a certain sombre charm in which were blended, perhaps, extracts of the flavour of preserves, the smell of the fire of logs, and of the pages of one of Bergotte's books, the colour of the stony front of the house opposite, all of which things still today, when they rise like a gaseous bubble from the depths of my memory, preserve their own specific virtue through all the successive layers of rival interests which must be traversed before they reach the surface. These were, commanding the distant sea from the crests of their several dunes, or folding themselves already for the night beneath hills of a crude green colour and uncomfortable shape, like that of the sofa in one's bedroom in an hotel at which one has just arrived, each composed of a cluster of villas, whose line was extended to include a lawn tennis court and now and then a casino, over which a flag would be snapping in the freshening breeze like a hollow cough. A series of watering places, which now let me see for the first time their regular visitors. But let me see only the external features of those visitors. Lawn tennis players in white hats. The station master spending all his life there on the spot among his tamarisks and roses, a lady in a straw boater, who, following the everyday routine of an existence which I should never know, was calling to her dog which had stopped to examine something in the road before going into her bungalow, where the lamp was already lighted for her return, which, with these strangely usual and slightly familiar sights, stung my ungreeted eyes and stabbed my exiled heart. But how much were my sufferings increased when we had finally landed in the hall of the Grand Hotel at Balbec, and I stood there in front of the monumental staircase that looked like marble, while my grandmother, regardless of the growing hostility of the strangers among whom we should have to live, discussed terms with the manager, a sort of nodding mandarin whose face and voice were alike covered with scars, left by the excision of countless pustules from one and from the other of the diverse accents acquired from an alien ancestry and in a cosmopolitan upbringing, who stood there in a smart dinner jacket with the air of an expert psychologist, classifying, whenever the omnibus discharged a fresh load, the nobility and gentry as geezers, and the hotel crooks as nobility and gentry, forgetting probably that he himself was not drawing 500 francs a month. He had a profound contempt for people to whom 500 francs, or as he preferred to put it, 25 louis, was a lot of money, and regarded them as belonging to a race of pariahs for whom the Grand Hotel was certainly not intended. It is true that even within its walls there were people who did not pay very much, and yet had not forfeited the manager's esteem, provided that he was assured that they were watching their expenditure not from poverty so much as from avarice. for this could in no way lower their standing, since it is a vice and may consequently be found at every grade of social position. Social position was the one thing by which the manager was impressed. Social position, or rather the signs which seemed to him to imply that it was exalted, such as not taking one's hat off when one came into the hall, wearing knickerbockers or an overcoat with a waist, and taking a cigar with a purple band and gold out of a crushed Morocco case, to none of which advantages could I, alas, lay claim. He would also adorn his business conversation with choice expressions, to which, as a rule, he gave a wrong meaning. While I heard my grandmother, who showed no sign of annoyance at his listening to her with his hat on his head and whistling through his teeth at her, ask him in an artificial voice, "And what are your charges?" "Oh, far too high for my little budget." Waiting upon a bench, I sought refuge in the innermost depths of my own consciousness, strove to migrate to a plane of eternal thoughts, to leave nothing of myself, nothing that lived and felt on the surface of my body, anaesthetized, as are those of animals which by inhibition feign death when they are attacked, so as not to suffer too keenly in this place, with which my total unfamiliarity was made all the more evident to me when I saw the familiarity that seemed at the same moment to be enjoyed by a smartly dressed lady, for whom the manager showed his respect by taking liberties with the little dog that followed her across the hall, the young blood with a feather in his hat, who asked as he came in, "Any letters?" All these people to whom it was an act of homecoming to mount those stairs of imitation marble. And at the same time the triple frown of Minos, Aeacus, and Rhadamanthus, beneath which I plunged my naked soul as into an unknown element where there was nothing now to protect it, was bent sternly upon me by a group of gentlemen who, though little versed perhaps in the art of receiving, yet bore the title reception clerks, while beyond them again, through a closed wall of glass, were people sitting in a reading room, for the description of which I should have had to borrow from Dante alternately the colours in which he paints paradise and hell, according as I was thinking of the unhappiness of the elect who had the right to sit and read there undisturbed, or of the terror which my grandmother would have inspired in me if, in her insensibility to this sort of impression, she had asked me to go in there and wait for her by myself. My sense of loneliness was further increased a moment later, when I had confessed to my grandmother that I did not feel well, that I thought that we should be obliged to return to Paris. She had offered no protest, saying merely that she was going out to buy a few things, which would be equally useful whether we left or stayed, and which I afterwards learned were all for my benefit, Françoise having gone off with certain articles which I might need. While I waited for her, I had taken a turn through the streets, packed with a crowd of people who imparted to them a sort of indoor warmth, streets in which were still open the hairdresser's shop and the pastry cook's, the latter filled with customers eating ices opposite the statue of Duguay-Trouin. This crowd gave me just about as much pleasure as a photograph of it in one of the illustrateds might give a patient who was turning its pages in the surgeon's waiting room. I was astonished to find that there were people so different from myself that this stroll through the town had actually been recommended to me by the manager as a distraction, and also that the torture chamber which a new place of residence is could appear to some people a continuous amusement, to quote the hotel prospectus, which might, it was true, exaggerate, but was, for all that, addressed to a whole army of clients to whose tastes it must appeal. True, it invoked, to make them come to the Grand Hotel Baalbec, not only the exquisite fare and the fairy-like view across the casino gardens, but also the ordinances of Her Majesty Queen Fashion, which no one may break with impunity, or without being taken for a Boeotian, a charge that no well-bred man would willingly incur. The need that I now had of my grandmother was enhanced by my fear that I had shattered another of her illusions. She must be feeling discouraged, feeling that if I could not stand the fatigue of this journey, there was no hope that any change of air could ever do me good. I decided to return to the hotel and to wait for her there. The manager himself came forward and pressed a button, and a person whose acquaintance I had not yet made, labelled Lift, who at that highest point of the building which corresponded to the lantern in a Norman church, was installed like a photographer in his darkroom or an organist in his loft, came rushing down towards me with the agility of a squirrel, tamed, active, caged. Then, sliding upwards again along a steel pillar, he bore me aloft in his train towards the dome of this temple of Mammon. On each floor, on either side of a narrow communicating stair, opened out fanwise a range of shadowy galleries, along one of which, carrying a bolster, a chambermaid came past. I lent to her face, which the gathering dusk made featureless, the mask of my most impassioned dreams of beauty, but read in her eyes, as they turned towards me, the horror of my own nonentity. Meanwhile, to dissipate in the course of this interminable ascent the mortal anguish which I felt in penetrating thus in silence the mystery of this chiaroscuro so devoid of poetry, lighted by a single vertical line of little windows which were those of the solitary water-closet on each landing, I addressed a few words to the young organist, artificer of my journey and my partner in captivity, who continued to manipulate the registers of his instrument and to finger the stops. I apologized for taking up so much room, for giving him so much trouble, and asked whether I was not obstructing him in the practice of an art to which, so as to flatter the performer, I did more than display curiosity. I confessed my strong attachment. But he vouchsafed no answer, whether from astonishment at my words, preoccupation with what he was doing, regard for convention, hardness of hearing, respect for holy ground, fear of danger, slowness of understanding, or by the manager's orders. There is perhaps nothing that gives us so strong an impression of the reality of the external world as the difference in the positions relative to ourselves of even a quite unimportant person before we have met him and after. I was the same man who had taken that afternoon the little train from Baalbek to the coast. I carried in my body the same consciousness. But on that consciousness, in the place where at 6 o'clock there had been, with the impossibility of forming any idea of the manager, the Grand Hotel, or its occupants, a vague and timorous impatience for the moment at which I should reach my destination, were to be found now the pustules excised from the face of the cosmopolitan manager. He was, as a matter of fact, a naturalized Monegasque, although, as he himself put it, for he was always using expressions which he thought distinguished without noticing that they were incorrect, of Romanian originality. His action in ringing for the lift boy himself, a whole frieze of puppet show characters issuing from that Pandora's box which was the Grand Hotel, undeniable, irremovable, and like everything that is realized, sterilizing. But at least this change, which I had done nothing to bring about, proved to me that something had happened which was external to myself, however devoid of interest that thing might be. And I was like a traveller who, having had the sun on his face when he started, concludes that he has been for so many hours on the road when he finds the sun behind him. I was half dead with exhaustion. I was burning with fever. I would gladly have gone to bed, but I had no night things. I should have liked at least to lie down for a little while on the bed, but what good would that have done me seeing that I should not have been able to find any rest there for that mass of sensations which is for each of us his sentient, if not his material, body, and that the unfamiliar objects which encircled that body, forcing it to set its perceptions on the permanent footing of a vigilant and defensive guard, would have kept my sight, my hearing, all my senses in a position as cramped and comfortless, even if I had stretched out my legs, as that of Cardinal La Balue in the cage in which he could neither stand nor sit. It is our noticing them that puts things in a room, our growing used to them that takes them away again and clears a space for us. Space there was none for me in my bedroom, mine in name only, at Baalbek. It was full of things which did not know me, which flung back at me the distrustful look that I had cast at them, and without taking any heed of my existence, showed that I was interrupting the course of theirs. The clock, whereas at home I heard my clock tick only a few seconds in a week when I was coming out of some profound meditation, continued without a moment's interruption to utter in an unknown tongue a series of observations which must have been most uncomplimentary to myself, for the violet curtains listened to them without replying, but in an attitude such as people adopt who shrug their shoulders to indicate that the sight of a third person irritates them. They gave to this room with its lofty ceiling a semi-historical character, which might have made it a suitable place for the assassination of the Duc de Guise, and afterwards for parties of tourists, personally conducted by one of Messrs. Thomas Cook and Son's guides, but for me to sleep in, no. I was tormented by the presence of some little bookcases with glass fronts which ran along the walls, but especially by a large mirror with feet which stood across one corner, for I felt that until it had left the room there would be no possibility of rest for me there. I kept raising my eyes, which the things in my room in Paris disturbed no more than did my eyelids themselves, for they were merely extensions of my organs, an enlargement of myself, towards the fantastically high ceiling of this belvedere planted upon the summit of the hotel which my grandmother had chosen for me. And in that region more intimate than those in which we see and hear, that region in which we test the quality of odours, almost in the very heart of my inmost self, the smell of flowering grasses next launched its offensive against my last feeble line of trenches, where I stood up to it, not without tiring myself further, with the futile, incessant defence of an anxious sniffing. Having no world, no room, no body now that was not menaced by the enemies thronging round me, invaded to the very bones by fever, I was utterly alone. I longed to die. Then my grandmother came in, and to the expansion of my ebbing heart there opened at once an infinity of space. She was wearing a loose cambric gown which she put on at home whenever any of us was ill, because she felt more comfortable in it, she used to say, for she always ascribed to her actions a selfish motive, and which was for tending us, for watching by our beds, her servant's livery, her nurse's uniform, her religious habit. But whereas the trouble that servants, nurses, religious take, their kindness to us, the merits that we discover in them, and the gratitude that we owe them all go to increase the impression that we have of being in their eyes someone different, of feeling that we are alone, keeping in our own hands the control over our thoughts, our will to live. I knew when I was with my grandmother that however great the misery that there was in me, it would be received by her with a pity still more vast. That everything that was mine, my cares, my wishes, would be in my grandmother supported upon a desire to save and prolong my life stronger than was my own. And my thoughts were continued in her without having to undergo any deflection, since they passed from my mind into hers without change of atmosphere or of personality. And like a man who tries to fasten his necktie in front of a glass, and forgets that the end which he sees reflected is not on the side to which he raises his hand, or like a dog that chases along the ground the dancing shadow of an insect in the air, misled by her appearance in the body as we are apt to be in this world, where we have no direct perception of people's souls, I threw myself into the arms of my grandmother, and clung with my lips to her face as though I had access thus to that immense heart which she opened to me. And when I felt my mouth glued to her cheeks, to her brow, I drew from them something so beneficial, so nourishing, that I lay in her arms as motionless, as solemn, as calmly gluttonous as a babe at the breast. At last I let go, and lay and gazed, and could not tire of gazing at her large face, as clear in its outline as a fine cloud, glowing and serene, behind which I could discern the radiance of her tender love. And everything that received, in however slight a degree, any share of her sensations, everything that could be said to belong in any way to her, was at once so spiritualized, so sanctified, that with outstretched hands I smoothed her dear hair, still hardly grey, with as much respect, precaution, comfort, as if I had actually been touching her goodness. She found a similar pleasure in taking any trouble that saved me one, and in a moment of immobility and rest for my weary limbs, something so delicious that when, having seen that she wished to help me with my undressing and to take my boots off, I made as though to stop her and began to undress myself, with an imploring gaze she arrested my hands as they fumbled with the top buttons of my coat and boots. "Oh, do let me," she begged. "It is such a joy for your granny. And be sure you knock on the wall if you want anything in the night. My bed is just on the other side, and the partition is quite thin. Just give a knock now, as soon as you're ready, so that we shall know where we are." And sure enough, that evening I gave 3 knocks, a signal which, the week after when I was ill, I repeated every morning for several days, because my grandmother wanted me to have some milk early. Then, when I thought that I could hear her stirring, so that she should not be kept waiting, but might, the moment she had brought me the milk, go to sleep again, I ventured on 3 little taps, timidly, faintly, but for all that distinctly, for if I was afraid of disturbing her, supposing that I had been mistaken and that she was still asleep, I should not have wished her either to lie awake listening for a summons which she had not at once caught and which I should not have the courage to repeat. And scarcely had I given my taps than I heard 3 others, in a different intonation from mine, stamped with a calm authority, repeated twice over, so that there should be no mistake, and saying to me plainly, "Don't get excited, I hear you, I shall be with you in a minute." And shortly afterwards my grandmother appeared. I explained to her that I had been afraid that she would not hear me, or might think that it was someone in the room beyond who was tapping, at which she smiled. "Mistake my poor chick's knocking for anyone else. Why, Granny could tell it among 1,000. Do you suppose there's anyone else in the world who's such a silly billy with such feverish little knuckles, so afraid of waking me up and not making me understand? Even if he just gave the least scratch, Granny could tell her mouse's sound at once, especially such a poor miserable little mouse as mine is. I could hear it just now, trying to make up its mind and rustling the bedclothes and going through all its tricks." She pushed open the shutters. Where a wing of the hotel jutted out at right angles to my window, the sun was already installed upon the roof, like a slater who is up betimes and starts early and works quietly so as not to rouse the sleeping town, whose stillness seems to enhance his activity. She told me what o'clock, what sort of day it was, that it was not worthwhile my getting up and coming to the window, that there was a mist over the sea. If the baker's shop had opened yet, what the vehicle was that I could hear passing? All that brief, trivial curtain-raiser, that negligible entrée of a new day, performed without any spectator, a little scrap of life which was only for our two selves, which I should have no hesitation in repeating later on to Françoise, or even to strangers, speaking of the fog, which you could have cut with a knife at 6 o'clock that morning, with the ostentation of one who was boasting not of a piece of knowledge that he had acquired, but of a mark of affection shown to himself alone. Dear morning moment, opened like a symphony by the rhythmical dialogue of my three taps, to which the thin wall of my bedroom, steeped in love and joy, grown melodious, immaterial, singing like the angelic choir, responded with three other taps, eagerly awaited, repeated once and again, in which it contrived to waft to me the soul of my grandmother, whole and perfect, and the promise of her coming, with a swiftness of enunciation and melodic accuracy. But on this first night after our arrival, when my grandmother had left me, I began again to feel as I had felt the day before in Paris at the moment of leaving home. Perhaps this fear that I had, and shared with so many of my fellow men, of sleeping in a strange room, perhaps this fear is only the most humble, obscure, organic, almost unconscious form of that great and desperate resistance set up by the things that constitute the better part of our present life, towards our mentally assuming, by accepting it as true, the formula of a future in which those things are to have no part. A resistance which was at the root of the horror that I had so often been made to feel by the thought that my parents must one day die. That the stern necessity of life might oblige me to live remote from Gilberte, or simply to settle permanently in a place where I should never see any of my old friends. A resistance which was also at the root of the difficulty that I found in imagining my own death, or a survival such as Bergotte used to promise to mankind in his books, a survival in which I should not be allowed to take with me my memories, my frailties, my character, which did not easily resign themselves to the idea of ceasing to be, and desired for me neither annihilation nor an eternity in which they would have no part. When Swann had said to me in Paris one day when I felt particularly unwell, "You ought to go off to one of those glorious islands in the Pacific. You'd never come back again if you did." I should have liked to answer, "But then I shall not see your daughter any more. I shall be living among people and things she has never seen." And yet my better judgment whispered, "What difference can that make, since you're not going to be affected by it? When Monsieur Swann tells you that you will not come back, he means by that you will not want to come back, and if you don't want to, that is because you will be happier out there." For my judgment was aware that habit, which was even now setting to work to make me like this unfamiliar lodging, to change the position of the mirror, the shade of the curtains, to stop the clock, undertakes as well to make dear to us the companions whom at first we disliked, to give another appearance to their faces, to make attractive the sound of their voices, to modify the inclinations of their hearts. It is true that these new friendships for places and people are based upon forgetfulness of the old, but what my better judgment was thinking was simply that I could look without apprehension along the vista of a life in which I should be forever separated from people all memory of whom I should lose, and it was by way of consolation that my mind was offering to my heart a promise of oblivion which succeeded only in sharpening the edge of its despair. Not that the heart also is not bound in time, when separation is complete, to feel the anodyne effect of habit, but until then it will continue to suffer. and our dread of a future in which we must forego the sight of faces, the sound of voices that we love, friends from whom we derive today our keenest joys, this dread, far from being dissipated, is intensified, if to the grief of such a privation we reflect that there will be added what seems to us now in anticipation an even more cruel grief. Not to feel it as a grief at all, to remain indifferent. For if that should occur, our ego would have changed. It would then be not merely the attractiveness of our family, our mistress, our friends that had ceased to environ us, but our affection for them. It would have been so completely eradicated from our heart, in which today it is a conspicuous element, that we should be able to enjoy that life apart from them, the very thought of which today makes us recoil in horror. So that it would be in a real sense the death of ourselves. A death followed, it is true, by resurrection, but in a different ego. The life, the love of which are beyond the reach of those elements of the existing ego that are doomed to die. It is they, even the meanest of them, such as our obscure attachments to the dimensions, to the atmosphere of a bedroom, that grow stubborn and refuse in acts of rebellion which we must recognize to be a secret, partial, tangible, and true aspect of our resistance to death, of the long resistance, desperate and daily renewed, to a fragmentary and gradual death, such as interpolates itself throughout the whole course of our life, tearing away from us at every moment a shred of ourselves, dead matter on which new cells will multiply and grow. And for a neurotic nature such as mine, one, that is to say, in which the intermediaries, the nerves, perform their functions badly, fail to arrest on its way to the consciousness, allow indeed to penetrate there, distinct, exhausting, innumerable, agonizing, the plaint of those most humble elements of the personality which are about to disappear, the anxiety and alarm which I felt as I lay outstretched beneath that strange and too lofty ceiling, were but the protest of an affection that survived in me for a ceiling that was familiar and low. Doubtless this affection too would disappear, and another have taken its place, when death and then another life would, in the guise of habit, have performed their double task. But until its annihilation, every night it would suffer afresh, and on this first night especially, confronted with a future already realized in which there would no longer be any place for it, it rose in revolt. It tortured me with the sharp sound of its lamentations whenever my straining eyes, powerless to turn from what was wounding them, endeavored to fasten their gaze upon that inaccessible ceiling. But next morning, after a servant had come to call me and had brought me hot water, and while I was washing and dressing myself and trying in vain to find the things that I wanted in my trunk, from which I extracted pell-mell only a lot of things that were of no use whatever, what a joy it was to me, thinking already of the delights of luncheon and of a walk along the shore, to see in the window and in all the glass fronts of the bookcases, as in the portholes of a ship's cabin, the open sea, naked, unshadowed, and yet with half of its expanse in shadow, bounded by a thin and fluctuant line, and to follow with my eyes the waves that came leaping towards me one behind another, like divers along a springboard. Every other moment, holding in one hand the starched, unyielding towel with the name of the hotel printed upon it, with which I was making futile efforts to dry myself, I returned to the window to gaze once more upon that vast amphitheatre, dazzling, mountainous, and upon the snowy crests of its emerald waves, here and there polished and translucent, which, with a placid violence, a leonine bending of the brows, let their steep fronts, to which the sun now added a smile without face or features, run forward to their goal, totter, and melt, and be no more. window in which I was, henceforward, to plant myself every morning, as at the pane of a mail coach in which one has slept, to see whether in the night a long-sought mountain chain has come nearer or withdrawn. Only here it was those hills of the sea, which, before they come dancing back towards us, are apt to retire so far that often it was only at the end of a long and sandy plain that I would distinguish, miles it seemed away, their first undulations upon a background, transparent, vaporous, bluish, like the glaciers that one sees in the backgrounds of the Tuscan primitives. On other mornings it was quite close at hand that the sun was smiling upon those waters, of a green as tender as that preserved in alpine pastures, among mountains on which the sun spreads himself here and there like a lazy giant who may at any moment come leaping gaily down their craggy sides, less by the moisture of their soil than by the liquid mobility of their light. Anyhow, in that breach which shore and water between them drive through all the rest of the world, for the passage, the accumulation there of light, it is light above all, according to the direction from which it comes and along which our eyes follow it, it is light that shifts and fixes the undulations of the sea. Difference of lighting modifies no less the orientation of a place, constructs no less before our eyes new goals which it inspires in us the yearning to attain, than would a distance in space actually traversed in the course of a long journey. When in the morning the sun came from behind the hotel, disclosing to me the sands bathed in light as far as the first bastions of the sea, it seemed to be showing me another side of the picture, and to be engaging me in the pursuit, along the winding path of its rays, of a journey motionless but ever varied, amid all the fairest scenes of the diversified landscape of the hours. And on this first morning, the sun pointed out to me far off, with a jovial finger, those blue peaks of the sea, which bear no name upon any geographer's chart, until, dizzy with its sublime excursion over the thundering and chaotic surface of their crests and avalanches, it came back to take shelter from the wind in my bedroom, swaggering across the unmade bed and scattering its riches over the splashed surface of the basin stand and into my open trunk, where by its very splendour and ill-matched luxury it added still further to the general effect of disorder. Alas, that wind from the sea, an hour later in the great dining-room, while we were having our luncheon, and from the leathern gourd of a lemon were sprinkling a few golden drops onto a pair of soles which presently left on our plates the plumes of their picked skeletons, curled like stiff feathers and resonant as citherns. It seemed to my grandmother a cruel deprivation not to be able to feel its life-giving breath on her cheek, on account of the window, transparent but closed, which, like the front of a glass case in a museum, divided us from the beach while allowing us to look out upon its whole extent, and into which the sky entered so completely that its azure had the effect of being the colour of the windows, and its white clouds only so many flaws in the glass. Imagining that I was seated upon the mole, or addressed in the boudoir of which Baudelaire speaks, I asked myself whether his sun's rays upon the sea were not a very different thing from the evening ray, simple and superficial as the wavering stroke of a golden pencil, just what at that moment was scorching the sea topaz brown, fermenting it, turning it pale and milky like foamy beer, like milk, while now and then there hovered over it great blue shadows which some god seemed for his pastime to be shifting to and fro by moving a mirror in the sky. Unfortunately, it was not only in its outlook that it differed from our room at Cambrai, giving upon the houses over the way this dining-room at Baalbek, bare-walled, filled with a sunlight green as the water in a marble font, while a few feet away the full tide and broad daylight erected, as though before the gates of the heavenly city, an indestructible and moving rampart of emerald and gold. At Cambrai, since we were known to everyone, I took heed of no one. In life at the seaside, one knows only one's own party. I was not yet old enough, I was still too sensitive, to have outgrown the desire to find favour in the sight of other people and to possess their hearts. Nor had I acquired the more noble indifference which a man of the world would have felt with regard to the people who were eating their luncheon in the room, nor to the boys and girls who strolled past the window, with whom I was pained by the thought that I should never be allowed to go on expeditions, though not so much pained as if my grandmother, contemptuous of social formalities and concerned about nothing but my health, had gone to them with the request, humiliating for me to overhear, that they would consent to let me accompany them. Whether they were returning to some villa beyond my ken, or had emerged from it, racket in hand, on their way to some lawn tennis court, or were mounted on horses whose hooves trampled and tore my heart, I gazed at them with a passionate curiosity, in that blinding light of the beach by which social distinctions are altered. I followed all their movements through the transparency of that great bay of glass, which allowed so much light to flood the room. But it intercepted the wind, and this seemed wrong to my grandmother, who, unable to endure the thought that I was losing the benefit of an hour in the open air, surreptitiously unlatched a pane, and at once set flying with the bills of fare, the newspapers, veils and hats of all the people at the other tables. She herself, fortified by the breath of heaven, remained calm and smiling like Saint Blandina amid the torrent of invective which, increasing my sense of isolation and misery, those scornful, dishevelled, furious visitors combined to pour on us. To a certain extent, and this at Baalbek gave to the population, as a rule monotonously rich and cosmopolitan, of that sort of smart and exclusive hotel, a quite distinctive local character. They were composed of eminent persons from the departmental capitals of that region of France, a chief magistrate from Caen, a leader of the Cherbourg Bar, a big solicitor from Le Mans, who annually, when the holidays came round, starting from the various points over which throughout the working year they were scattered like snipers in a battle or draftsmen upon a board, concentrated their forces upon this hotel. They always reserved the same rooms, and with their wives, who had pretensions to aristocracy, formed a little group, which was joined by a leading barrister and a leading doctor from Paris, who, on the day of their departure, would say to the others, "Oh, yes, of course, you don't go by our train. You are fortunate. You will be at home in time for luncheon." "Fortunate, do you say? You who live in the capital, in Paris, the great town? Well, I have to live in a wretched county town of 100,000 souls. It is true we managed to muster 102,000 at the last census, but what is that compared to your 2.5 millions? Going back, too, to asphalt streets and all the bustle and gaiety of Paris life?" They said this with a rustic burring of their R's, but without bitterness, for they were leading lights, each in his own province, who could, like other people, have gone to Paris had they chosen. The chief magistrate of Caen had several times been offered a judgeship in the Court of Appeal, but had preferred to stay where they were from love of their native towns, or of obscurity, or of fame, or because they were reactionaries, and enjoyed being on friendly terms with the country houses of the neighbourhood. Besides, several of them were not going back at once to their county towns, for, inasmuch as the Bay of Baalbek was a little world apart in the midst of a great world, a basketful of the seasons in which were clustered in a ring good days and bad, and the months in their order, so that not only on days when one could make out Rivebelle, which was in itself a sign of coming storms, Could one see the sunlight on the houses there, while Baalbek was plunged in darkness? But later on, when the cold weather had reached Baalbek, one could be certain of finding on that opposite shore 2 or 3 supplementary months of warmth. Those of the regular visitors to the Grand Hotel, whose holidays began late or lasted long, gave orders when rain and fog came and autumn was in the air, for their boxes to be packed and embarked, and set sail across the bay to find summer again at Rivebelle or Costa d'Or. This little group in the Baalbek Hotel looked with distrust upon each new arrival, and while affecting to take not the least interest in him, hastened all of them to ply with questions their friend the head waiter. For it was the same head waiter, Aimé, who returned every year for the season and kept their tables for them. And their good ladies, having heard that his wife was expecting, would sit after meals, working each at one of the little things, stopping only to put up their glasses and stare at us, my grandmother and myself, because we were eating hard-boiled eggs in salad, which was considered common, and was, in fact, not done in the best society of Alençon. They affected an attitude of contemptuous irony with regard to a Frenchman who was called His Majesty, and had indeed proclaimed himself king of a small island in the South Seas, inhabited by a few savages. He was staying in the hotel with his pretty mistress, whom, as she crossed the beach to bathe, the little boys would greet with 3 cheers for the Queen, because she would reward them with a shower of small silver. The chief magistrate and the barrister went so far as to pretend not to see her, and if any of their friends happened to look at her, felt bound to warn him that she was only a little shop-girl.
"But I was told that at Ostend they used the royal bathing machine."
"Well, and why not? It's on hire for 20 francs. You can take it yourself if you care for that sort of thing. Anyhow, I know for a fact that the fellow asked for an audience when he was there with the king, who sent back word that he took no cognizance of any pantomime princes."
"Really? That's interesting. What queer people there are in the world, to be sure." And I dare say it was all quite true, but it was also from resentment of the thought that, to many of their fellow visitors, they were themselves simply respectable but rather common people who did not know this king and queen so prodigal with their small change, that the solicitor, the magistrate, the barrister, when what they were pleased to call the carnival went by, felt so much annoyance and expressed aloud an indignation that was quite understood by their friend the head waiter, who, obliged to show proper civility to these generous, if not authentic, sovereigns, still, while he took their orders, would dart from afar at his old patrons a covert but speaking glance. Perhaps there was also something of the same resentment at being erroneously supposed to be less and unable to explain that they were more smart, underlining the fine specimen with which they qualified a young blood, the consumptive and dissipated son of an industrial magnate, who appeared every day in a new suit of clothes with an orchid in his buttonhole, drank champagne at luncheon, and then strolled out of the hotel, pale, impassive, a smile of complete indifference on his lips, to the casino, to throw away at the baccarat table enormous sums, which he could ill afford to lose, as the solicitor said with a resigned air to the chief magistrate, whose wife had it on good authority that this detrimental young man was bringing his parents' grey hair in sorrow to the grave. On the other hand, the barrister and his friends could not exhaust their flow of sarcasm on the subject of a wealthy old lady of title, because she never moved anywhere without taking her whole household with her. Whenever the wives of the solicitor and the magistrate saw her in the dining-room at mealtimes, they put up their glasses and gave her an insolent scrutiny, as minute and distrustful as if she had been some dish with a pretentious name but a suspicious appearance, which, after the negative result of a systematic study, must be sent away with a lofty wave of the hand and a grimace of disgust. No doubt, by this behaviour, they meant only to show that if there were things in the world which they themselves lacked, in this instance certain prerogatives which the old lady enjoyed, and the privilege of her acquaintance, it was not because they could not, but because they did not choose to acquire them. But they had succeeded in convincing themselves that this really was what they felt, and it was the suppression of all desire for, of all curiosity as to forms of life which were unfamiliar, of all hope of pleasing new people.